Okay, now you all heard the keynote, so I won't repeat it. And we'll just throw it open for Q&A and discussion, whatever. Yes?
One of the things that I really like about a lot of what you said is you bring out, and this is probably, I don't know if this is a Christianese word, but discernment. A lot of Christians, I don't know how to think critically without being fearful of being wrong or being perceived as being too liberal. And my issue is, even with my job, is how do you know when to change? I know sometimes you know you need to change and you know you don't need to change, but how do you make, sometimes the discernment isn't always clear cut?
Well, it's certainly true that not only Christians, but a lot of people don't know how really to think. I think part of the problem there is the educational system. We're not taught how to think, you know, and very few people study logic anymore, certainly not in high school. And many people get by nowadays in college without taking much in the way of liberal arts, you know, and that sort of thing. So it is difficult to know. You know, as I mentioned, Christian Smith's sociologist at the University of North Carolina doing that national survey, a huge survey of high school kids. And, you know, they would say they believe in Christ and everything, but they couldn't give a reason. You know, they couldn't, So I think a lot of times people just say, well, they have a gut feeling, you know. What people fail to understand about gut feelings is, of course, there is an undisclosed thinking process going on behind the gut feeling, you know. They think that it's simply somehow in the intestines or something like that, but it isn't, you know, it's in the brain. And so I think that what helps is to be as informed as possible about the decision or, you know, the matter at hand, to be as informed as possible, to be as frank as you can with yourself about your motivation, you know, so that the reason doesn't become a rationalization, you know, or perhaps misinterpreting something that somebody did or said something where you're personalizing, and so then, you know, you feel bad and you want to get out of there, you know, that sort of thing. So you do have to kind of know yourself as well as possible and question yourself about your motives and talk to some people maybe that you trust in terms of their wisdom and their objectivity, to the extent that they can be objective about you and so on. And you certainly can pray about it for a sense of, you know, after doing what you can do about it, to, you know, pray that God's will be done. And then I think a lot of times it's a more simple thing to figure out, for example, what God's will is than a lot of people make it. You know, I often say it's relatively simple to know God's will. It is to love God with everything you have and your neighbor as yourself. And it's not a matter of, you know, to which city is God calling me, to which side of the street is God calling me, you know, and that sort of a thing. And so it becomes, you know, the focus stays on, you know, the really significant things. God doesn't really, God doesn't really care if you know, wear your blue shirt or your yellow shirt.
Or your pink shirt.
Or your pink shirt. I think God probably concerns himself as to whether or not it has been worn several times. Because that wouldn't be loving your neighbor. We're not aware of our own stink. Another. Yeah.
I remember a while back reading a book by a Jesuit priest called John McNeil.
Oh yeah, I've known him years ago.
Yeah, and he wrote one thing he wrote that was very striking is that Catholic seminaries used to be centers of critical thinking, now they're turning into centers of indoctrination. And it turns out that this phenomenon is not limited to the Catholic faith. I mean, a lot of seminaries have become that way. When did we ever lose that tradition of critical thinking? That Socratic thinking.
Well, I think a great deal of it has to do with postmodernism. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much some of you know about that, but it's not just a seminary. There is indoctrination and propaganda in the gay movement.
Yeah.
There's a political correctness about thinking in the gay movement. Even people who talk about diversity, it's a very selective diversity. No diversity of ideology, for example. Just diversity of color. So I think that you have to just be as wise as serpents and harmless as doves, and try and learn your logic and so on. But every group tries to politically control the people within it. No matter, as they say, whether it's religious or secular or left wing, right wing, whatever. So
Well, that's what I also wanted to attend to, because part of your keynote is where I was nodding my head, because I wrote an email to a young friend of mine about religious neutrality. This is during the Supreme Court decision of the Ten Commandments and what the First Amendment actually said about religion and freedom of religion. And I told him that, the reason why the religious neutrality clause in our amendments, constitutional amendments, exists is to keep this country from turning not only into a religious theocracy, but also a secular theocracy. And I even listed examples like China, the USSR, just like you did. And I said, oh, wow, incredible. So I really thank you.
Well, I thank you for clarifying that, because when you were nodding your head, I thought it was something else. Somebody else.
We were talking in my group about economics and how we use our money and just in terms of your first point, which was what's the word, the consumerism.
Yeah.
And so then we were talking about giving money away to various things. And then we were talking about examining the organizations that we were giving money to, how they were politically aligned, or how do we know how to wisely give our money to the service of the Lord, but not, how do we know how to give our money wisely to the service of the Lord, number one? And in giving our money, do we have to give a tithe to the church and then money to other philanthropic organizations, or is any money that we give to philanthropic organizations considered money given to the Lord?
Well, you see, the phrase money given to the Lord is an interesting one, because if you're giving the money to the Lord through an organization or through some other people, you are giving the money to the Lord. Your responsibility is to give it to the Lord, and He's not there to give it to. So you give it to his followers. Once you give the money to the Lord through his followers, it's the followers' responsibility to be faithful to their stewardship with the Lord. You see? It's not your responsibility. Now, you can look into, an organization and give according to what you believe is the right thing, But very often we don't know all the ins and outs of an organization. But again, we give it to the Lord, we do as well as we can to figure out, you know, is this a responsible organization and so forth, and you give money to them. And once the money leaves your hand, there are no strings, you see? And I think the illustration of this, of course, is the widow's mite, right? She is celebrated in the scripture by Jesus saying she gave all she had. Now when you think, to whom did she give all this money? Well, she gave it to God. But through whom? A very corrupt religious machine. Mm-hmm. The equivalent, really, of the mafia today. And Jesus said as much. See? And yet she was commended for her faithfulness in giving it as unto the Lord. You see? And once it's given away, it's the responsibility of the priests and the, you know, whatever, the organization, to do with it as they purport, or, you know, as they should. So. And then, you know, to divvy up and say, well, I gave a tithe to my church, you know, and how about this other organization? Keep in mind, you know, again, New Testament vocabulary, the church is the body of Christ, you know, not the First Baptist Church on the corner. So there's no distinction between the First Baptist Church on the corner and EC and InterVarsity and, you know, whatever. So you give your money to the Lord through the Lord's disciples and say, bye-bye. Yeah.
This is like a, more like a two-part question.
Okay.
So the first part has to do with just, it's obvious that when you talk about feelings in your lecture this morning, mm-hmm. You didn't mean that feeling has no place in one's life at all. And this is more like a clarification question about that point, because on some level, logic is very important because it is more objective than the subjective feeling. Mm-hmm. But yet on the other hand, there's something about the gospel, the essence of the gospel, that is in some way quite subjective and illogical. Because like for example, a mathematician, if he were to create a god, a religion, probably he's not capable of writing the gospel, a narrative. Because there's something, and I don't mean it's illogical, but I mean it's not kind of this kind of deductive logic in a very linear sense. So I guess, and also another part of that is, there's a mystical tradition in Christianity mm-hmm. that, like the centering prayer, mm-hmm. the meditation, the silence, and so just kind of how they should all be put together mm-hmm. in the jigsaw puzzle. Mm-hmm. And the second part of the question.
One thing save that and I'll get to it. Or I'll forget everything. Certainly critical thinking or theoretical thought is not exhausted with formal logic. Formal logic is one form of critical thinking or theoretical thought. But you mustn't confuse critical thinking with just the very fine rules of formal logic. So that's one thing. But if you notice, everything that we think of as subjective, even, for example, you gave an instance of the centering prayer. Even behind the centering prayer is a rationale, you see. Otherwise, there's no point in advocating the centering prayer. Now, once you have thought through the reasonableness of a centering prayer, and can even justify it, you know, and say why it's helpful and so forth. Then, of course, the experience is indeed subjective. There's nothing inferior about the subjective. In other words, cognitive intelligence is not superior to an emotional intelligence, but it is, in terms of sequence, prior. Then once you even engage in the centering prayer, you cannot help but have a response of the intellect, an interpretation. You know, in other words, you think it's reasonable to do it again, and you know, and so forth, or you reflect on it. You know, so both before and after the actual subjective. You know, I mean, you want something good to happen to a neighbor, and then it happens, and you feel good about it, you know, and that sort of thing. So there is an interactive influence of emotion and cognition. But what I was trying to point out is that the cognition is something you can get your hands on and actually change unwanted feelings by changing your cognition. You cannot change unwanted feelings simply by, you know, telling them to go away, or, you know, say cheer up, or don't be afraid. You see, for example, on the don't be afraid, every time in scripture the command would seem to be to order a person's feeling to change, don't be afraid, it's followed up by a reason, isn't it? Don't be afraid, for behold, I bring you good tidings of great joy, which shall be to all the people. You see, what is that? That's the good news, cognitively mediated. Once I understand that good news, in some sense cognitively, of course I'm overjoyed that, you know, that this is true, you see. But without a meaningful intellectual understanding of the good news, then I don't feel any joy. I still am depressed about my sin, and, you know, and so forth. So every time, you know, Jesus says, don't be afraid, there's always the follow-up as to why, and that makes good psychological sense. So you see, I'm not saying that the cognitive or the intellectual is superior. I'm just saying, if you understand, what am I saying to myself? Because what I'm saying to myself brings on these unwanted feelings of fear, for example. If I feel fear, it means I think there's danger. I'm in danger. Well, let me examine that. Am I really in danger? You know, I'm going to a job interview, and I'm nervous. I'm fearful. Well, I can't say, well, you know, I have to calm myself down, you know, have a stiff drink or, you know, something like that to calm my nerves. No. If I realize, wait a minute, what's the danger? Well, maybe the guy I'm going to interview with, he's going to pull out a gun and shoot me to death. No, I don't think he's going to do that, you know. And you argue, what's the worst thing could happen in this interview? Well, I suppose I'm thinking the worst thing could happen is that I won't be hired. Well, why, on what basis do I say that would be a horrible thing? Everybody has gone to a job overjoying when he or she was hired, and then a few weeks or months later, can't stand it, has to get away, you know, looking for another job, see? But so long as the job that I'm fantasizing is the job that, oh, it'll be so wonderful if only I get it, it'll be very fearful if I don't, you know, and so forth, you see? So, I don't need this job, you know, not defensively take this job and shove it, you know, not that. I don't need this job, I need a job. So I'll go, show up. They might like me, they might not. If they don't like me, would it be pleasant to work there? No. So, hey, you see, I think it through. Oh, I feel okay, I go to the job interview, you see? Second part.
So the second part is, given the fact that we live in a society where formal logical training is absent, mm-hmm. when a lot of the, like you just mentioned, the critical thinking fostered by liberal arts education mm-hmm. is very greatly diminished, given that we live in a culture where the consumerism is supreme, where feelings are central, mm-hmm. Feelings are God, and where there's this polarization of all the things that you talk about, given that, how do you begin to approach people who are not sold yet on this kind of belief system that we're trying to support? So it's kind of like if you are the therapist and a patient comes into your office to see you, and you know exactly what this patient needs to go, but I'm assuming at some level you have to start with what the patient has right now. mm-hmm. i.e. the feeling and the mm-hmm. subjectivity and the consumerism and the polarization. So can you give us some idea how we can use, mm-hmm. how we can begin to engage mm-hmm. that society using the elements in there mm-hmm. and how to, yeah.
Well, I try and be as, pleasant and accepting and, you know, show the person that, you know, I'm not, you know, don't hate him, you know, that sort of thing. But then, you know, I try and ask him and pull him out and get him to talk about his fear, you know, because if you ask, very often if you ask somebody, how are you feeling? The person will not respond with feeling vocabulary. How will they respond? They'll say something like, I'm feeling rejected. Well, there's no such feeling as rejected, you see. That's a cognition. That's an interpretation. That's a belief. That person has rejected me. So what they really mean is, I feel hurt. Yes, you feel hurt. And if I were a good Rogerian therapist, I'd say, you feel hurt. Yes, I do. And I will weep with you, and you will weep with me. Time's up. But as a good cognitive therapist, I would say, you know, rejected is not a feeling. It's a story you're telling yourself. It's how you're interpreting it. Now, I can understand why you're thinking that you were rejected, and I can understand, you know, because of what you've told me, and I can understand why you would feel bad about that. But let's examine what causes the feeling. And that's the idea that I've been rejected, and I need not to be told no, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And you work that way, you see. And so then pretty soon, since you're actually facilitating that person's learning some actual tools of thinking, see, that person begins to get a mastery of some basics of critical thinking, so that the hint that I'm not thinking straight is, you know, felt in the gut. You know, I'm feeling hurt, or I'm feeling scared. You know, that sort of thing. So that tells you what the problem is, because if you can identify the feeling, you can then move from identifying the feeling to, what am I telling myself? Even if you don't, you know, respond to the question, how are you feeling, with, I've been rejected, you see. But if you understand that always and inevitably the feeling of fear is rooted in the belief I'm in danger, see, or the feeling of frustration is rooted in the belief that I need it to go a certain way, and I myself need to make it go that way, which is obviously irrational because other people play their parts, and, you know, I can't control them. You know. But then if I only think, well, but, oh my goodness, I can't control all this, you know, and I need it to go away a certain way, but I only play my part, and then you say, that won't help you, because you'll still have this anxiety about it, but then you say, but you don't need it to go a certain way, and then point out that that's because you're predicting how it would be if only, and you don't have a crystal ball, and, you know, that sort of thing. So I'm not poo-pooing feelings, but I'm saying you have to understand and identify the thinking behind the feelings, because, as I said this morning, the head bone, right? What did I say? The heart bone's connected to the head bone. Right. Is that clearer? You feel better now?
I feel better, but I'm confused as to what thinking is contributing to that feeling better.
You changed your mind a little bit, you see? You got a little clarification, you see? You think, oh, he's not downplaying emotions. Is that a relief, you see? Yeah, somebody over here, yeah.
I had a question of what you said about us being in the world and of the world. He said, admittedly, we are of the world, although we try not to be as Christians. What do you see, what areas do you think that we can work on as the gay or GLBT Christian community to further set ourselves apart from the world?
Well, I think just to constantly be becoming, you know, a more mature Christian and knowing what is important and what isn't for discipleship, and then the more you get centered on that sort of thing, then the more obvious will be, you know, the counter to that, you know. And as I said, loving God with everything you have and your neighbor as yourself. Well, then, you know, on a specific thing like promiscuity, well, how is that either loving yourself or loving your neighbor, you see? You know, if the more critical you think about it, no, you know, I'm just very foolishly trying to meet a perceived need that can't be met that way, you see? But I am bringing onto myself and my neighbor all kinds of reinforcement of what I mentioned yesterday in the sex time as incest taboo, you know, and making it more and more difficult to maintain a robust, genitally expressed life in continuing partnership, you know, and that sort of thing. So I think it's just a matter of becoming a more and more mature Christian and therefore becoming more sensitive that way to when I am slipping off the path, you know. Yeah.
So my whole coming out experience kind of resulted in me kind of feeling very betrayed by the church. And that came out just 3 years ago. And so now as I try to choose a church for myself, having grown up in the South, I've learned that a lot of the stuff that I heard coming from the church, you know, really, as far as, you know, my orientation, all that was not right, and I expect there's a lot of other things out there that are just not right either. And so how do I maintain sort of a critical thinking, you know, whatever, position, listening, whatever, however you want to call that, as I sit in church and I listen to what's being set up front? How do I, you know, I don't want to just say, okay, I've checked off the homosexuality box, the church was wrong about that, but I'm going to go sit back in church and just take it all in. You know, how do I maintain that critical thinking about what I'm hearing from people in the church, from what's being said up front?
Well, that is a problem, and I think that a twin problem of that, I think, is, and it's especially a temptation of mine, to be too hypercritical, you know, when I hear people talking, and, you know, and thinking, oh, that's stupid, and, you know, and that, of course it is, but... I think one of the things you can do is just say, look, everything is a mixed bag. You cannot find the perfect church. And things that you might hear in church at one point in your life that you think make sense, at another point doesn't make sense. But maybe, you know, I mean, no, the whole world doesn't move at the speed that we move, you know, and so forth, and other people move ahead of us, and, you know, that sort of thing. So we don't always have an opportunity to find a real good match to, you know, exactly where we are at any particular time. But sometimes it's helpful, rather than to even find that perfect match, is to be a little behind the curve of the ministry, you know, under which you place yourself, so as to be drawn ahead, you know, because the temptation is for people to church shop and just plunk themselves down where they agree with everything that the minister says, and if the minister says something that they don't agree with, then they pick themselves up and they go elsewhere, or they say, well, to hell with the church, or, you know, something like that.
Right.
Even the term the church is a mistake, because when you say the church abused us, I know what you mean, but No, some particular, ill-informed preacher did, or a bunch of preachers, you know, that sort of thing. And even some of those preachers have changed their minds in the meantime, you know, that sort of thing. So I do think that we have to be careful that we don't set ourselves up for looking for the perfect church. And by the way, you know, as somebody has already said, you know, if you find the perfect church and you join, you know, it's now imperfect. So, but go where I think the important thing is, not so much even on the gay issue, but where can I be nurtured? Because there are people who are not up to speed about what exactly homosexuality is, but they do have a very helpful teaching ministry about a lot of other things, yeah. You know, and you can do that through reading, you know, books of people who they may not be on the same page with us on homosexuality, but on other matters, they're very helpful. And I find that a lot of times the local congregations or denominations that have the most pro-gay approach are often very unhelpful when it comes to actually nurturing us, you know. I mean, the only major denomination that has come out for same-sex marriage is the UCC, you know, United Church of Christ, sometimes called Unitarians Considering Christ. And, you know, that's really sort of a comical expression, but you know that right now in the UCC, they are debating whether or not it'll be required of UCC ministers to believe in the deity of Christ.
Yeah.
And it may well pass, according to, you know, the people on the inside. Well, you know, how are you going to get nurtured, you know, there? The Anglican Church in England has just put out a study, results of a study called Fractured Faith, in which it has been discovered that a third of the Anglican priests in England do not believe in God. A third. No wonder the African Anglicans think we've gone to hell, you see? I mean, you know, on Bishop Robinson, for example. I have no idea where Bishop Robinson stands on anything. And evidently, nobody either against Robinson or for Robinson gives a damn. Because I have never seen it discussed. All I understand from all the publicity and all the, you know, is, you know, these people hate him because he sleeps with somebody of the same anatomy, and these people love him because he does. You see? I don't know where he stands on anything. Is he with Bishop Spong, you know, in denying all the cardinal doctrines of the faith, or is he, you know, with, you know, Sam Shoemaker, the great, you know, Episcopal priest of a bygone era. I don't know. So, I think that we must select where we go, where we can be nurtured, and where we can minister, and certainly not where we're uncomfortable, you know, we have to be careful about, you know, letting anybody know we're gay, because then they'll have a conniption. That's Ohio for... I've lived in New York City since 1969. What is the Yiddish term?
I
forget. Anyway. Yeah. Did you have a? Who had a question? Yeah.
I just had a follow-up to the in the world question earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a difference between the promiscuous world and the political world when it comes to a gay Christian? For instance, fight for marriage equality. What's the role of a gay Christian in delving into the political world for something that could actually help avoid the promiscuity? Because currently there's no institution for same-sex couples to enter into.
I'm not sure I know what you mean.
Being of or not part of the world, is there a difference between being politically in the world?
Oh, in other words, maybe not being of the world would exclude you being involved in politics?
Right, as a Christian.
No, because, in this country, under a democracy, you know, we get to voice our opinion and we get to vote and so forth, which was not the way it was in Paul's day or Jesus' day. was not particularly democracy and so on. So, to be good citizens, as we're called to do in the New Testament, you exercise your right to vote and all of that. And if you believe that it would be a good thing to have an enhancement of stability for same-sex couples, then do whatever you can for that.
But the energy to fight for a new right or equality takes a tremendous amount of energy.
Oh yes, but it always has. The evangelicals who fought against the slave trade it was a lot of effort. And the evangelicals who fought for women's rights, it was a big hassle, and who fought against segregation, and, I mean, you have to, we've heard all along, you have to count the cost. Are you up for it? And some people, maybe they just aren't up for it, and okay, they're not up for it, but somebody else is, you see, and at least we can get out on election day and cast our vote or something like that. But one of my clients was all upset. Did I mention this in the other workshop? After the election, because he hates Bush, and so he was going crazy. And so I said, "Well, look, you did what you could do. You voted. You get a vote. You voted. Well, I need to do more." And I said, "Well, maybe you could write a letter to the editor." "Yeah, I'll write a letter." I said, "But just in a second. When you read a letter to the editor in the Times, and it's pro-Bush, what's your reaction?" "Idiot!" And I said, "And when you read an anti-Bush letter in the Times, what's your reaction?" "Right on!" I said, "Okay. Now, do you suppose we might extrapolate from that and say, if you write a letter, and if it gets printed, it'll be similar kind of reaction. People who agree, say right on. The people who agree, say idiot. So what have you accomplished in terms of what you wanted to accomplish? Might it not be better for you to put your energy into finding a job?" So I think we have to, we have to count the costs, and we have to look at our priorities, and that sort of a thing.
It's spreading the energy to spread the gospel. Is that if you put all your energy into some political, then you, if it's for a common good, is that equivalent to spreading the gospel?
Well, keep in mind that it depends on how narrowly you define the gospel. The gospel is God's good news of the kingdom of God come to earth, and I think part of that, at least my reading of it, is that we not condemn other people just because they they found themselves attracted to the same sex, and not to condemn them, and understand that their homosexuality does not trump the good news that God was in Christ reconciling the world to himself, you see. And so then to work to assure such people that they are included in God's love, and that sort of thing is part of the spreading of the kingdom of God, you see. And I think that maybe sometimes we make too much of a distinction between the secular and the sacred. For the Christian, all ground is holy ground, and every bush is a burning bush. You know who said that? I didn't tell you so that you thought, "Oh, that sounds nice. Now I'll tell you who said it." Did anybody know who said it?
Roslyn.
No. Bob Jones Sr. Yeah?
Ralph, I'd like to talk a little bit more about moving on to higher ground. And I wonder if you could do that for me in terms of what you consider to be true spiritualities. What are the... You talked about pseudo-spiritualities in these three sets of philosophies or assumptions. Could you turn the coin around and talk about true spiritualities and specifically sort of actions that, would move us towards true spirituality? I personally believe that action changes our thinking and our view.
Oh, yes. Yes, and you know who else believed that? Even before you. John Wesley. John Wesley, you know, and it is true. You know, I mean, and I advise that too sometimes, you know. I mean, sometimes somebody is sitting there, you know, feeling depressed and is sitting in the chair. You know, I say, sit up, you'll feel better, you know. You know, I mean, you know, it is true. And John Wesley used to say, okay, you don't believe some tenet of the faith, but act as though you believe it, and you may indeed begin to believe it, you know, if you put it into practice and so on. So that is certainly true. But notice that even that is rooted in a cognitive understanding of what might happen if you did it, you know, and so on. So that's a good point. I would say true spirituality is God was in Christ reconciling the world to himself. Nothing, you know, really is as basic as that. That God was in this particular man, Yeshua, HaMashiach, Jesus, the anointed one of Israel, who immediately, even before his resurrection, was perceived as come from the Father by people who knew him, you know, for 3 years, and then certainly after the resurrection. Unlike the lies of Dan Brown, and it's amazing how many Christians think Dan Brown is great. You know, the
Da Vinci Code.
The Da Vinci Code, you know.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, he says that, well, you know, nobody thought of Jesus as divine until 400, you know, 300 years later. And so forth. It's nonsense. It's clear from the Gospels and from Paul's letters written from about 10 to 15 years after the resurrection, you know, that he was already seen by monotheistic Jews as Yahweh in the flesh. You know. Imagine, what significant intervening variable could explain that? Psychologically, we can't explain it. It's either true or there's no other explanation. So I would say true spirituality is rooted in that gospel, that God, that good news. God, and that's of course where we get the word evangelical, right? Euangelion. Good news. Good announcement. God was in Christ, reconciling the whole world to God. Now, if that is true, and that's what we believe, then it sets the agenda for everything. It sets the agenda for all of our priorities. It sets the agenda against decompartmentalizing our lives and prioritizing, you know, in such a way that, you know, we have a place for church and we have a place for
sex.
You mean against compartment? Yes. So that everything comes, has to come to terms with that. Now, I think as at the beginning of Christianity, as well as all through the history of the church, people have different opinions about a lot of different things, you know, styles of worship. I myself am not a fan of praise courses. It's a bad place to come for that. But that's okay. Some people, it's very meaningful for, you see. So, you know, there's a wide berth for styles of worship. There's a wide berth for various theological interpretations of things, you know. Calvinism, Arminianism, you know, all kinds of things. But Romans 14 makes it very clear that on the non-essentials, and remember when Paul wrote Romans 14, what he was saying were non-essentials, things that all through the history of Israel were seen as absolutely essential. Circumcision and dietary laws and you see, all this sort of thing. The goyim, the Gentiles, dogs. These were really fundamentals. Not little things like homosexuality. And so Paul wrote Romans 14 to say, hey, you all get together on the essentials and agree to disagree about these other things. But unfortunately, the church, all through history, and certainly today on the gay issue, for example, isn't abiding by it. And so, you know, in the Episcopal Church, you have fights, political power struggles, because they ignore Romans 14. We have to win. We have to win. And in every other denomination, Presbyterians are doing the same thing. Splitting churches. Churches have been split all, you know, over all kinds of nonsense, looking back on it. You know. So agreeing on the essentials and not having to agree on the non-essentials, but the rock-bottom gospel that God was in Christ, as Paul says, reconciling the whole world to himself, that is, we cannot give any ground on that. So I don't know if that makes a little sense, but it's a beginning to think of it. Yes?
Talking about the political struggles in the Episcopal Church, I sometimes wonder, just want to see what you think about this, how much of it has to do with the paradigm of the civil rights movement?
How
much has to do with the paradigm of the civil rights movement, where you consider this righteous cause and speaking truth to power and civil disobedience and really just going out there with your beliefs? So like that was the first movement. Then they make the sequel, and the sequel's maybe not quite as good on the next class. And then the third and the fourth, and now we're like on the eighth sequel. And we're still using that paradigm of the civil rights struggle, and that's why everyone's still out there on these issues, that maybe aren't quite as...
Yes. Well, I do think that no doubt there were people very sincere on both sides of the civil rights struggle of the 60s, for example. But forcing other people to be where they weren't, there is a price for that. In other words, there's still racism. You see? The only way you can really move ahead is for people to actually change their minds. You can't force them. And that's the mistake, I think, that's being made in the churches today on the gay issue, when they turn it into a politics and who is more powerful to get rid of these Episcopal priests because we have this guy as our bishop, you know, and then you know, the opposite point of view, bishop over here, you know, he's getting rid of the other. And so I think that kind of thing doesn't do anything except breed, you know, self-righteousness on both sides and contempt for the others and so forth. Whereas, as they were saying last night, telling their stories and finding out what gay people really are like, and the more people find that there are gay people in their families, and so they begin to have a vested interest in changing their minds. You know, I mean, nobody woke up and all of a sudden discovered that their son was black. You know, if they were white. So they didn't have that vested interest, you know, that was intrinsic to their family. But that's happening all the time with gay issues. So I think that the more people have a vested interest to change their mind, the more they will. And those who have a vested interest in not changing their mind, such as leaders of the political religious right, I mean, you know, you're never going to... see Jerry Falwell change his mind, because that's his bread and butter, you see. But somebody who's in Jerry Falwell's church, who has a lesbian daughter, might have a vested interest to listen, you know, and try and understand. And they don't necessarily change their minds because they have a vested interest in the eternal damnation of their daughter, or they misbelieve that they didn't cause this. Okay, enough. Can't be that funny. But you see, so you have to capitalize on the vested interest of other people, and otherwise it's naivete. Otherwise, it's just making me feel good. You know. Well, an example, you know, the Live 8 rock concerts of a few weeks ago. Lots of very well-meaning people got excited about that. How much did it actually put food into the stomachs of Africans? None. Because The problem in Africa is the corrupt regimes that control those countries. And you send money to them or food to them, it goes through the corruption of the government. So that has to be changed before you can do anything. But the Live Aid concerts not only entertain, but make people feel good. See? And we have to do more than go after making ourselves feel good. We have to really do something to change things in an effective way. See? That's where the command to be as wise as serpents and harmless as doves comes in. And very often, we are as wise as doves and harmless as serpents. Unintentionally. We're as wise as doves unintentionally, but we're as harmless as doves, as serpents unintentionally. Yeah?
I have another question. It's true that sometimes tons and tons of food is just confiscated by governments, or people pay people off to, sit a couple crates of that over here.
Yeah.
But some of these programs you see on television, like, I don't know, World Vision or Feed the Children or something, you see the food actually going into a child's hand with a cup. Or you, I saw a program where they went in and, I forget what it was, they made, small wells.
Yeah.
I can't remember if that was for sure, but
dug wells. Yeah.
It was a way to get water easily.
Yeah.
And those things are good.
Oh yes. Oh yeah. I'm not. I'm just saying. You know, some of the things though that get all the publicity, like that Live Aid. You know.
You have to really watch out for.
Oh yes.
Because you don't know.
At least if some people go in there and help the natives.
To an agency that's already set up.
Yes.
Process.
Yes. And if they go in and dig a well for a village. You know, the well is of no use to the power structure sitting in the nice palace, in the capital, so so the well will be there,
How it's being sent, who's receiving it at the other end.
Yes, exactly.
My other question, the one that I really wanted to ask you, and I couldn't quite, and we were going pretty fast this morning, and there was something, you said something about a person or somebody whining about the GLBT something buying into the marriage thing.
Right.
I didn't quite get what you were saying.
Oh, I just had a couple of quotes. One, the director of the transgender political action thing in New York, condemning the LGBT community for wanting to buy into what she called the coercive institution of marriage. In other words, we want to do away with buying into that heterosexual scheme and just invent the wheel, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's all the rights and stuff that married people get. Are you saying that's good or bad?
That's dumb.
Yeah.
That's dumb.
Buying into marriage?
Huh?
To buy into marriage?
No, to condemn the buying into marriage, as the, because Rivera said, the head of the Rivera,
that it was just
that the marriage institution is unredeemable because it just corrupt, because it's a power play, and that sort of thing. It's heterosexual. And,
I understand.
So, as though we haven't learned over a few years from mistakes and so forth about some institutions of support for,
But then you could have civil unions. You could inherit. You have to pick. Is it a cafeteria? You get your partner's pension, or.
They probably don't think it through that much.
When you get married, you get this whole string of responsibilities. You get their debt too.
Oh sure, yeah,
but,
yeah. And the thing about marriage for same-sex couples, which is so good, I always call it that rather than same-sex marriage, because it's just marriage extended.
Yeah.
To same-sex couple. Is that anything that helps to structure a relationship is helpful, so that people you know, I mean, sometimes people split because, you know, all they really needed was a bowel movement. And, they were too constipated to figure out what was going on in their relationship. So they're out the door.
It's like on the one hand, there's no structure, so anything goes, and it went too far, and we had a lot of problems. But then they say we're promiscuous, but then when we want to get married, they don't want us to do that. No. And it's like they can't quite decide what they want, and then we don't.
Yeah, but I mean, they're not thinking straight, you know.
Yeah.
But I do think any underpinnings that help people through rough times are good. And there's a brand new book, an excellent book by a friend of mine, a heterosexual social psychologist, one of the most brilliant social psychologists in the country, by the name of Dave Myers, who is on the faculty at Hope College. And Letha Scanzoni worked with him on the book, and it is a book supportive of same-sex couples having the right to marry. And it's a Christian argument. And Dave brings in research from the social psychological research. Those of us who are not social psychologists sort of sometimes raise our eyebrows at the research of social psychologists, because in the clinical setting, you hear people tell the truth about how they see themselves. Social psychologist asks, do you feel good about yourself? I sure do. Oh, most people feel good about themselves. I mean, it's a little bit of naivete there. But anyway, some good social psychological research on some of the ways in which sexual orientation may, the ideological literature may prove. So that's brought together nicely there. And
what's the name of the book?
I knew somebody was going to ask me. It's such a generic name, I always forget what exactly it's called. But if you look it up, on the web, Dave Myers, David G. Myers, M-Y-E-R-S, put that and same-sex marriage or something like that. Do you know the name of it? I have a blurb on the dust jacket, but I can't remember.
It's a room full of free computers down there.
Huh?
It's pretty easy to find on Amazon. Sure.
Yeah. Just put Myers and Scanzoni. M-Y-E-R-S. M-Y-E-R-S. And it's by San Francisco, Harper San Francisco. It's something like the, I forget which is the subtitle and which is the title, but it's just very generic. The editors didn't come up with a very snazzy title. But. Yeah.
This may seem like a somewhat simple question, but I would welcome what you view as why it appears that the gay population is so heavily oriented towards secularism.
Why what?
The gay population is so heavily oriented towards secularism.
Well, I think the society of the elites is secular. Somebody once said, the leadership in terms of the culture in America is run by Scandinavians, and they are running a country filled with Hindus, by which of course they meant, the masses are very religious, and the leadership is, as religious as Scandinavia, which is, nil. So the culture elite is extremely secularist. And they are the ones on the cutting edge of being inclusive about homosexuality, obviously. So the religious masses are not quite up to speed on that, you see. And that, I think, explains it. And even though I have been working in this for, I was speaking for the integration of homosexuality and Christian faith in 63, 64, and in fact, put my job on the line with university and was let go because I was doing that in 64. and started the Homosexual Community Counseling Center in New York City in 71, and the Homosexual Counseling Journal, and all that kind of stuff. And was speaking at gay conferences all the time. But as soon as I started EC, those invitations dried up. And since Google, where my clients, for example, in New York, which are atheists, fairies, you know, radical fairies, Jews, agnostics, and a couple of Christians, and they recommend, you know, their friends come to me for therapy because they like me. Their friend Googles me and sees all this evangelical stuff. No way. No way. So I do think that you know, the leadership is, as you say, very tied to a secularist assumption, and so they confuse anybody identified as evangelical, you know, even though it doesn't make any sense in my case, but they nonetheless, they think, oh, that Blair is gonna, you know, he's trying to, you know, make you a Christian or something. So there is that dichotomy in the country, and there is that dichotomy then in the gay world too. You know, I mean, I had a friend, not a friend, he was a client of mine, and he came to therapy, and then he began to hear about the Bible study and our Eastern Connection and so forth. So he came to the Eastern Connection, and he has since died. He had AIDS. And his friends, all of his friends, when they heard he was coming up to the conference, they said, the best thing that could happen at that conference is if the whole place was bombed and everybody's killed. You know? That's it. These were these gay leadership people.
Why?
Well, because they hate, you know. Well, Jesus said they would hate, if they hated him, they'll hate us, you know. I mean, yes, some people have been hurt by churches, but they've also been hurt by schools, and they don't hate the schools, and they've been hurt by, you know, one political party or another, and they don't hate that. You know, there is a spiritual underpinning to a lot of this, okay? And we just have to understand.
It could be power, too.
Huh?
It could be power, too, because, you know,
it could be what?
It could be power. They would lose some of their power because you say, well, we have to have a higher authority, then it's not going to be them as much, you know, it's going to be them, right, but it's going to be somebody else.
Yeah, I think a lot of the anti-Christian bias in the gay movement is really, you know, just a lot of rationalization, you know.
But to be fair, isn't it true that it's for people who don't have necessarily an experience with Christianity, discerning between you as an evangelical and Jerry Falwell is like asking me to discern between various Muslim groups that I really know nothing about, but they may have very, very different worldviews.
Well, I don't buy that, because if I were Jerry Falwell, why did I start the Homosexual Community Counseling Center? The Homosexual Counseling Journal, you know?
Maybe you've changed it and
maybe I, yeah, exactly. No, I mean, it's
And we as thoughtful Americans know that there's a variety of Muslims.
Yeah.
You know, and some thoughtful Americans aren't required to know.
And besides, their friends, who aren't even Christians, who may be radical fairies, are the ones who are saying, you should go see Blair. You see?
Yeah.
No, I Googled him. He's one of those right-wingers.
But then they should come back and say, when you Google him, or if you look at his website, you'll see he's Christian. But, like, no, don't worry, he's not
going to
open his Bible and start throwing it
out. Well, they could even see, you know, the EC website is a pro-gay thing, you know?
All they got to do is read the website.
Well, they see the catchwords.
Yeah.
I think it's part of the spiritual battle underpinning.
Yes, I think you're right. I think you're right. There is a spiritual, there is, you know, Paul said there's warfare going on.
There's a malaise, a spiritual malaise.
Yeah, exactly. Now, that is not to justify, you know, we then get to chalk everything up to, you know, they hate me because they hate Jesus, you know, and I'm such a Jesus person. But I do think we mustn't be naive about as Paul said, we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers in the heavenly places. And we have to take that seriously.
I think it's important to understand that when you're dealing with people that are, have so much hatred against you that's unjustified.
Yes.
Or else you won't know how they're going to react.
Exactly. You know, well, the same thing is true just on a psychological level. You know, if somebody is really revved up against something, you have to say, well, where is this coming from, you see? How come no just indifference? Let's see. Yeah.
I've met a number of people here who are children of ministers.
Yeah.
And they're gay. And it's, what do you think? Is there an extraordinary number of ministers' children who turn out to be gay?
No, I don't think
or
so.
Or is that just...
I think it's just that, you know, they were reared in the church. Maybe they wandered away for a while or whatever, you know, and then they hear that, you know, this is a group of people in the church who are gay and putting it together, and so they come. I would say probably most of the people here are not children of ministers, right? I like to be mean to this one from New York. Yeah.
There's a growing number of straight people who are finding what we found long ago, that they're so out of step with the evangelical fundamentalist church that they just have to leave. And they're trying to find different ways of doing church and being disciples of Christ. And I'm wondering what you think of the so-called emerging church.
Well, I have a reputation for being sometimes not tactful, right?
Who's that guy? He must be a very untactful person.
Very smart man up here. And this isn't just about the emergent church. This is about a lot of different things. I think a lot of times things are gimmicky. And if people feel more comfortable worshiping in a certain kind of context, you know, and that is meaningful for them, fine, it's great, you know. But I think a lot of times there's a kind of overkill about, you know, I was hurt in the church and so I can't walk into a church building or, you know, I mean, I'll tell you, the very first connection we have in 1980 in the East at Kirkridge for the Sunday morning worship service, there were so many people there that did feel that they had been abused in the church and so forth, because after all, most of the people were people who came to me through therapy, for therapy, and they coming from Catholic backgrounds and they hated the church anymore, and, you know, those are... So the question came to me, well, you know, what do we do about Sunday morning the service, the worship service? And there, the room where we usually meet has windows wrap around windows with a big stone fireplace behind and the mountains out here in the wind, through the window. But usually the chairs were going looking this way at the chimney or the fireplace. So for Sunday morning, I turned all the chairs around so they could look out over the valley. And we didn't have a preacher, we didn't have the Eucharist, we didn't have anything. It was a kind of Quaker style. I was smart enough not to offend any possible Quakers by calling it a Quaker service, but it was a Quaker style service. And so that it would be at least threatening, you know. And it turned out to be a nice kind of respite from, you know, some of the stuff that they were otherwise used to. But I, you know, I think that if you try to shape a situation like that in the emergent church, or like we did, like we continue to do at Kirkridge on Sunday, or even, you know, I, you know, sometimes joke about, you know, I'm not a great fan of praise courses, but that's great. Plenty of people love them, you know. And I'm a big fan of Southern Gospel, you know, gospel quartets and all that. Some people look at me like I'm crazy. Even here, they don't know of these great singers, Dottie Rambo and all these people. But, you know, whatever, you know, look, there is such a wide variety of personalities and histories represented among Christians that whatever facilitates, with the fewest distractions, an opportunity to get together with other Christians on the same page and focus on the essential gospel that God was in Jesus reconciling the world to himself. More power to you.
Aren't I've recently become associated with a community in my hometown that is like this, and what I found is that the reason that they left the church wasn't because they didn't hurt or was style, it was over really serious issues to do with the way power was used, the way money was used, all the do's and don'ts that had been added to the gospel, it just didn't seem important to them.
Yeah, and
but what happened when I came out to them was instead of I was hoping for at best, you know, that they would take a reserved judgment, but in fact, was all these profoundly evangelical people just welcomed me with open arms and open heart, which surprised me. And
I think that we must be very careful, though, that we don't set ourselves up for a lot of hurt by expecting that because this bunch left this bunch, because this bunch was too rigid, that this bunch will never become rigid, you know.
But,
yeah. Because there's always that tendency, that temptation, to want to duplicate ourselves in those around us, you know. And anybody else have anything? Yeah. And by the way, anybody who came in late who didn't get a free copy of the talk, is there anybody like that here? We'll make sure that you get one so you save $4 coming here. So, pass this back to you. And you didn't get one?
Was there somebody over here?
Yeah, I had a question.
Yeah.
In your opinion, what's our best angle trying to reach the gay community for Christ, to evangelize? We talked about the secularism within the gay community and within elitism in general. We're called to go forth and make disciples of all the nations. I think our nation, in this respect, is the gay community, the larger gay community.
Mm-hmm.
How do we approach that? How do you see us?
Well, there is a concept, you know, called friendship evangelism, and I think that is extremely important. When you know, you don't exactly have a building to invite people to and that sort of, but just to be candid about your own faith and how important it is, and one of the hooks can be just to bring up that, you know, what did you do over the weekend? Well, I went to this conference, and, you know, a whole bunch of gay people were trying to be serious about their Christian commitment and that sort of thing. Because people are hungry and people are hurt and people are resentful. After all, you know, the people who don't want to darken the door of a church because they were kicked out or made to be persona non grata, whatever, this is a case of unrequited love. It's not that they don't love Jesus and didn't want to continue in the church, but the church said things that didn't sound like I'm wanted here, you know, and that sort of thing. So they stopped going and so forth, and they understandably got resentful and so forth, because that's the way we handle hurt. We get hostile, right? The feeling of hurt is as though we're being acted upon, and that's not a very good way of experiencing things. So then we have to get in charge and, you know, be hostile, either just aggressive, actively aggressive, or passively aggressive and pouting and, you know, whatever, because it seems like that gives us the upper hand, but it doesn't solve our problem. So there are people, and you'd be surprised, some of the people even in your own circles, that maybe you didn't even hear people talking about your Christian faith or something, and And it would be a way of getting into it by just saying where you went over the weekend, or the GCN way of having heard about it, and there's gay Christians all over, and that sort of thing. And, you know, then not to expect to, you know, begin, end, and conclude every deal, you know, on, you know, in 5 minutes. If they know you're a Christian, they're watching. They're observing, right? They're taking note. And what does it say in the New Testament? They'll observe you, and you know, by their love, they'll know you, and they'll want to know, well, how do I get this, right? It's one of the most damning, you know, phenomena in the church, that you don't have people, you know, banging down the doors of churches saying, how can I have what you have? See? Can you imagine how far we have fallen, that people aren't banging down the door asking, how can they have what we have? There are other institutions where people are banging down the doors, you know, Harvard Business School. I want what you have. What is it called? I never go there.
What is it?
Brookdale.
I don't know.
Bloomingdale.
Do you think I'm a secular?
You know, so people are battering down the doors of, you know, where they can get what they think will enhance them, obviously. And going into great financial debt to do so. I always tell my clients, they save so much money by coming to therapy, because, you know, they don't then have to spend all this money trying to impress other people, you know, and so forth, and they agree with me, you know. But people are in tremendous debt in this country because of trying to feel better about themselves and that sort of thing. So just be the best Christian you can be, and you know, they'll, in fact, ask you.
Sorry?
They'll ask you. You know, I want what you have. I mean, that's one thing. Especially when you come from that tiny little town where you come from. You know, he comes from a little town just down the road from where I got my doctorate up at Penn State. I had never heard of this little town. That's how small that little town is. What is that called again?
Port Matilda.
Port Matilda. Never heard of it. I was there when I was kicked out of university, I went up there and was an American Baptist chaplain for a year, and then stayed on for 3 years more. So I was there for 4 years. Never heard of Port Matilda. There was somebody came to the Eastern Conference from GCN, came from a town called Pillow, Pennsylvania. Tiny little gay man from that town. Wherever, you know. Pillow, Pennsylvania? It's where Pillow Presbyterian is. You know, that's the church where they sleep in on Sunday morning? Mattress Methodist? I was dumb enough to tell him, to say, oh, that must be where Pillow Presbyterian is, as though, you know, no one has ever said that to you. Yeah. Well, probably never, nobody ever, you know, I mean.
Anything came up with a better one.
That's not mine. Church of the Holy Comfort, I've heard.
Oh, Church of the Holy Comfort, yeah. We have time for one more intelligent than...
That's pressure, I think. I was just wondering, on this note of evangelism, I agree that friendship evangelism, I think, can be the most effective, certainly how I became a Christian. But when I think back, I was all of the tender age of 16, and through a friend was hearing about the gospel, and I sort of tuned in eventually what he was talking about, and then eventually became a Christian. I was fortunate that there was a church nearby I could go to, and I did not bother going to church much before that, and being gay wasn't really on my mind at that time. However, I did grow within the context of a supportive Christian family who became like brothers and sisters to me, and, you know, and
Baptist Church, the Orthodox Latin Church, the Middle Church. However, I find quite often now, if I'm sharing my faith or in conversation with a non-Christian friend, gay or lesbian friend, you can go so far and it's great and there's a sharing and having some emails to follow up or etc. But I'm often at a loss as to say to them where they might find some follow-up and support if they are seriously interested in faith, and in fact do.
And are these people not living in your town?
Sometimes they are. I live in Hong Kong, actually.
Oh, Hong Kong.
I go home to Canada every summer.
You're the one of these people that has to be careful where you put your churn down.
Singapore.
Oh, Hong Kong, right.
That's shooting all over.
Oh, okay.
But actually, there's a Cantonese-speaking gay Christian fellowship there, and I did make friends with a Chinese guy, and was able to tell him about that. He's very active in that, and very sincere. However, I did attend the Metropolitan Community Church in Toronto for 4 years, many years ago, but I know now, if I go back, that it seems to have changed quite a bit. I'd almost say after. It's sort of, it's so ecumenical now in many ways that trying to be everything and everyone that it's almost nothing to no one. And I find that very frustrating because I can't be sure if I say to this friend, a gay or lesbian friend, hey, if you'd like to investigate more about this or any other Christian, you could go to this place and you're here with the same message. I'm not sure I can say that.
No. Well, I think you're wise to be concerned about the person's welfare in that sense. You know? I mean, there was a woman who came to our Eastern Conference, and she played the guitar and sang and that sort of thing, and she moved to Boston and went to an MCC, and they found out she could play the guitar and sing, and so they wanted her to, you know, do something in the service. But they said to her, but don't sing about Jesus, because that would be offensive to some people. There are some nice, good MCC congregations, and some that aren't, and so you don't know. I think that now, fortunately, with the internet, there are some sites that you can refer people to get some good stuff. And certainly, Justin's site has lots of good stuff on it, and even some non-gay sites. Over the years, I've been associated with the Ravi Zacharias International Ministries. Anybody know Ravi Zacharias? Very good man. And there's a website, RZIM, and in Slice of Infinity, you can get delivered to your computer every day for free. And it's well-written, little sort of devotional kind of thought-provoking. You know, it's basically an apologetics ministry, and I've been, for example, to the Founders Weekends there, for many years, and I have never heard anybody on the team or any of the guest speakers ever say any hostile thing about homosexuality. So you wouldn't be afraid of having something there, you know. I mean, I'm not guaranteeing that somebody wouldn't. Right, but you know, in general, it's not that. So to help them nourish themselves with some good reading material and that sort of thing, and of course, nothing can substitute for personal interaction. But even the GCN, you're at least talking with other people who are serious about their Christian faith, by instant messaging and whatever the chat room. I don't know how to do all that, but You have to use your imagination, be creative, and so forth, because it's not so easy to find some good connecting. Speaking of good connecting, I have 1 minute to give you a plug for our preaching festival in Ocean Grove, New Jersey, over the Columbus Day weekend. And this is the third year we've brought over Roy Clements. Who here heard Roy Clements here a few years ago? Yeah, and he's one of the best preachers there is, and each fall I ask him to give 4 sermons in Ocean Grove, and it's right on the ocean, beautiful Victorian town, most Victorian town in America, rapidly becoming gay gentrified, but a beautiful, lovely place, if you've heard Roy once, you'd love to hear him many times, and so That's the Friday, Saturday, and Sunday of Columbus Day in Ocean Grove. And you can fly right into New York, into Newark Airport, and get the train out of Newark Airport straight to Asbury Park, which is right across the street from Ocean Grove. So there's no problem getting there. And it's on our website. And in the Resource Center, there's some flyers. So who thinks you might want to come? Ocean Grove. Come on. Come on. It's beautiful. Isn't it beautiful?
Yeah.
October by the ocean, the Atlantic Ocean. You guys don't know what an ocean is. You know, Pacific, just Pacific. The Atlantic Ocean.
Oh, you have been here for a second.
Thank you for being good at asking questions and listening.